Don't you know? Talking about a revolution sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today is Thursday, February 20th, 2014, and here are some of the headlines we'll be looking at today. The NSA is snooping on trade negotiations, an interesting way to protect American business. We'll take a look at that. Obamacare is going to cover all insurance company losses. We've mentioned that before, but there's some more interesting information about that. We may even be able to get to climate change if we have enough time during the show. It's something we've been wanting to talk about for quite some time. And we're going to start off the hour talking about monetary and particularly the anniversary, the 50-year anniversary of the Obama stimulus. But we're actually going to start off with a piece of news that's hot off the press. The Winklevoss twins, you know them. They're the ones who kind of got, well, from their view, shafted from the point of view of Zuckerberg, pushed off the Facebook thing because they were never involved in the first place, according to him. But they have been involved in Bitcoin for quite some time. We, of course, like to talk about and sometimes make fun of Bitcoin at various times. Well, looks like they've taken Bitcoin to another level, Bill. Did you get a chance to take a look at that? That was kind of an interesting little news piece.
I don't think it's really consequential, but let's go for it.
No, not consequential. There's nothing consequential about Bitcoin, but it's fun.
Well, the Winklevoss twins are kind of fun, too, and particularly the name of their new price index or service, whatever it is, it's called the Winkdex.
The Winkdex! Yeah,
gotta
love it!
It's called the Winkydex.
I love it. I mean, these guys, I don't know how to say this nicely, they're really bad at investing. They're very wealthy. They're Harvard grads. They're twins. And they just don't get it. I mean, when I look at, I don't know how much you know about the story of how they feel like they got screwed when Facebook came out.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
I mean, they were trying to make a dating site. And Facebook wasn't a dating site. Come on, guys.
Well, it is novel, and maybe it's a... an event is the fact that they registered this Winkydex with the Securities and Exchange Commission, which, you know, if the SEC says, yeah, okay, it's fine, then at least they have a little bit of credibility, and you know, they're basically in it for a buck to get the transactions between dollars and bitcoins and make their little transaction premium. And become millionaires, even though they have a lot of luck with their efforts with Facebook.
But, I love the name that they came up with for the company. Did you see that? It's the Math-Based Asset Index, LLC. I mean, boy, that just really grabs you by the throat.
Is there an acronym for that that works?
I believe it's MBAE.
MBAE. Oh, well, that's good. Can't do eBay. That's long
gone. Well, MBAE would be where you go and waste a lot of money on bitcoins, yeah. But you do it on an auction basis.
Yeah. No, it's we've talked about it at length before, so I won't repeat our proposition. But there are people out there who are making money at this because they're running it as speculators. I mean, the value of bitcoins bounced up and down, and there are certain people who have privileged positions in banks and that sort of thing that are bouncing in and out of the currency, and that's one reason for the volatility. But there was also a very interesting C-SPAN interview with one of the Bitcoin, I think it was from the Bitcoin Foundation, trying to explain Bitcoin to people on C-SPAN. But it was interesting, some of the comments he made, basically saying, yeah, this is a very risky proposition. You don't want to go into it until you understand it. Of course, that limits the number of people to a half dozen geeks on the internet.
I mean, the one good thing you can say for the whole thing, particularly where the Winklevoss twins are concerned, is that they've got a lot of money to lose. So, you know, they're going to really help the economy.
It's an economic stimulus that actually benefits somebody.
Of of course, the flip side of all the people who have made money on Bitcoin is that a lot of them went out and lost most of it when it got stolen on the Silk Road, but that's another story.
Yeah, well, the Silk Road got nailed for, I think they calculated it, several $100 million when the feds closed them down because they were laundering money or selling drugs or who knows what. So that's going to happen more and more often as things go on. Although there are some countries that seem to be saying, yeah, sure, you know, let's get in on this and let's figure out some good rules. And there was actually a hearing on Capitol Hill the other day, the Bitcoin people saying, yeah, you know, we'll comply with all the regulations. Just do something that makes sense. Well, that's a pretty hard bargain for any politician.
That's pretty hard for any regulator to do at any time because it's not one of the criteria for getting a job. I mean, you know, if you want people to make sense, you should actually hire them for that basis, don't you think?
Yeah, I'd say that would be a plan.
Yeah, but that's not the way they're hired.
So anyway, aside from the Winklevoss stimulus, we're 5 years into the Obama stimulus package, which is actually misnamed. It wasn't the Obama stimulus package. It was the Bush stimulus package. It was passed by the Congress before Obama even got elected.
That's a great way to get credit for something, you know? You actually get credit for something that happened before you got elected, so you don't have to do anything.
So he signed this $800 billion stimulus plan that was supposed to fix all of the housing problems and everything else. And, you know, everybody was talking about it in Congress today, but... it was the news event of 2008, and it's still with us.
Oh, yeah, it's the gift that keeps on giving. The thing is that I noticed more than anything else about the celebration of the 5 years is that, of course, it depends on which news outlet you listen to. If it's an outlet that's associated with conservatives, then they tend to be poo-pooing it. If it's associated with liberals, they tend to be lauding it. And the basic storylines really haven't changed in 5 years.
No.
The people who are in favor of it say it's been wonderfully successful. People who are against it say it's been a horrible failure. And the rest of it saying, what stimulus?
Well, there were a lot of people who did benefit from the stimulus, mostly financial service centers on Wall Street, and Fannie and Freddie, of course.
Well, they certainly needed the most help. Yeah.
And you know, what's really strange about the stimulus is that Bush, along the way, wanted to modify the stimulus program so that it would allow him to bail out GM, you know, and use the money to stimulate the United Auto Workers. The Congress refused, but Obama said, we're not going to stimulate GM, we're going to stimulate GMAC, which is the financial arm of General Motors that deals with all of the purchase of automobiles and financing and credit and all that sort of stuff. So technically,
which is also where all the losses were, so it kind of made
exactly,
sense if you believe in bailing out losses, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so they got around the law, and Obama's getting around the law whenever the opportunity arises. So that was.
Actually that's part of President Obama's legacy. I mean, say his legacy is going to be Obamacare, the Health Care Act, but really I think his legacy is going to be ignoring Congress.
Well, when you have an obstinate Congress and you can't get anything passed and you're not signing anything, you have to do something that makes it look like you're actually, you know, being productive in the office. It's slightly different from Clinton's reaction. Clinton, when he got an opposition Congress, started negotiating. You know, and he signed an actual welfare reform bill the Republicans proposed. So he did it substantially differently than Obama has, which is basically to say, hey, I've got the pen. I can put out executive orders anytime I want.
Exactly.
And he's been doing that.
He's the king of executive orders. Oh, I'm sorry, the president of executive orders. But, yeah, that's why I say that's been his legacy, because really Obamacare itself would not even be holding together if not for the fact that President Obama follows the policy of using executive orders to do whatever he wants to do.
Well, it's collapsing in spite of his executive orders, but I guess we have that on our agenda later.
Well, I mean, when you have the ability to just sign papers endlessly, you can hold it off for quite some time.
You know what it is. It's the reason why he can get away with all this stuff is because Congress doesn't have the guts to stand up to him, and they've written laws that defer to the executive and the various administrative branches the power to create laws. And it's something called the Administrative Procedures Act that allows the president and allows all these different federal bureaucracies to write any laws they damn well please. And they automatically become laws, even though Congress has never even looked at them.
So President Obama is basically taking that framework and playing it out to the nth degree, which is what a smart politician does. It's not what an ethical politician does, but it's what a smart politician does.
And he's
shown exactly how this whole thing actually plays out. He's actually, in kind of a backward way, he's performed a public service. I mean, he has, really. I know that sounds funny, but he really has, because what he's essentially doing is turning what is euphemistically called a democracy, which is really a republic, but what's euphemistically called a democracy, he's turning it into an autocracy. And he's doing it just by signing his pen to paper.
Well, the other reason you can get away with this is that it takes a long, long, long time to get a challenge, constitutional challenge, up to the Supreme Court. And he can basically ignore anybody else, you know, the district courts and the appeal courts and all that kind of stuff. So there's dozens of lawsuits, whether it's on NSA or Obamacare or whatever it is he's been doing. There is no decision going to come down from the Supreme Court for another year or two, long after the election. So what does he care? He can do whatever he wants and get away with it because nobody can stop him. He's got the guns.
And plus, the president has recognized that what it's really all about is kind of taking a lead from Congress, because Congress passes all these mammoth bills that nobody ever reads. They're thousands of pages long. I mean, the amount of paper that is printed just to create the bills, you know, takes down a few forests every year. And he realized that when you push that much legislation through, it can't be stopped because no one knows what the heck's going on anyway. So he just followed the same principle. He just started signing executive orders so quickly that nobody can keep up. And, you know, it's a smart tactic to play. It's a smart strategy.
There was an amusing talking point. I can't remember whether it was one of the officials or press spokesman. Who said, well, you know, the president's ignoring the law. He's changing the Obamacare, but he's doing it in the way that the Republicans think is proper. You know, they've been complaining about this thing, so we fixed it. Mm-hmm. Of course, we didn't ask them for permission to fix it, but, you know, we did what they wanted us to do.
Which shows just how ineffectual the Republicans are, because look what the result was. Okay. Let's see. Was there anything else that we wanted to talk about regarding monetary policy? Well, there was Venezuela. Do we want to mention the riots in Venezuela? It's kind of like a precursor of what could happen here, I suppose.
Yeah, well, we could talk about Venezuela, you know, just in terms of their inflation and total mismanagement of the economy. I mean, if you're talking about an autocracy, this is a dictatorship.
Yeah.
And they do pretty much whatever they please, and the whole economy is going to crap. And people are protesting and making a stink about it because they, you know, can't go to the store and buy bread. The government decided it was lower priority, and so they have a shortage of, you know, like toilet paper, you know, simple consumer items in Venezuela that they're trying to cope with. But they're just doing it all on a huge pretense.
Now, I have to say the Venezuelan government has a few things to learn about how you con your own people. For instance, they put out an official inflation rate of 56%. They really need to take lessons from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which has refined to an art form the ability to understate the inflation rate by playing with the curves and playing with, you know, weights and adjustments and all that kind of stuff. And if Venezuela was smart, they would apply some of those same principles and turn that 56% rate down to, like, you know, 10%.
Yeah. So there was one other story in the monetary category that I thought we could mention, and that was the story about banks profiting on food stamps. Because, you know, people consider this a, you know, it's a good charitable, you know, egalitarian program that gives people food when they're starving to death. And there was a story from the Prospect, good left-wing organization, you know, media organization, explaining how much money different companies were making on food stamps. Now, the number of food stamps, the dollar amount of food stamps has doubled in the past year or so. Well, according to the General Accountability Institute, J.P. Morgan Chase controls all of the EBT, and that's electronic debt cards that are now used for all the food stamps. They control in 21 states, Guam, and Virgin Islands, and they're making more than $500 million processing those EBT transactions since 2006 or so. So it's an interesting thing that what is considered a left-wing, you know, fantastic program is making these corporate moguls millionaires. They're making billions of dollars off of all of these programs.
I wonder how the liberal intelligentsia feels about that, because it's kind of a catch-22 for them. I mean, on the one hand, they're kind of, you know, the poster children for, you know, the rich and the poor, the rich getting richer, poor getting poorer, and unemployment and labor unions who are getting the shaft and all this kind of stuff. And on the other hand, they're also the ones who are the biggest supporters of expansionary monetary policy, which is what makes it possible for banks to continue to do what banks do so well. Well, you know, food stamps is just kind of one more way to pour more money into that gigantic, endless tank of, you know, losses.
Well,
so they can keep making money on stuff that they had no right to make money on. And, it just fits nicely into that, but it's got to be really uncomfortable for the liberal intelligentsia.
Yeah, well, the thing is, it doesn't fit the military-industrial complex idea, but the corporatist idea that government is there to benefit the corporations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the whole premise for the Fed expansion program. That's the whole basis for the stimulus.
Well, for the liberal
perspective,
anyway.
To benefit the people that are running the biggest corporations, because they're the most powerful and the politicians need their support.
Right, exactly.
That's such a boring topic.
I know. Well, we had to touch on it.
We say it other times every show.
It's in the contract, so, you know, we had to do it. I saw one other note that you passed along. Texas Hold'em is a federal crime. Is this news?
Well, here's the key. I mean, it's... basically, the feds have, it wasn't the feds, it was Congress, that passed a law that said banks cannot engage in any transactions for gambling establishments unless they're certified by the state and, you know, controlled and regulated and all this kind of stuff. So what happened was there was a Texas, charitable group that put on a hold'em poker game in their local community. And the feds came down and they said, hey, you can't do this. This is illegal. You can't sponsor any kind of game of chance that involves cash and do it in any way that results in a profit for you. And so they shut them down. And this was just a small business owner, a guy by the name of Lawrence DeCrista, who was running games in the back room of his store or whatever it was, and was making, 5% on the transactions.
Mm-hmm.
And they came in and said no. So he's got a lawsuit. Basically, his point is that poker is the same thing as golf betting or bridge or Scrabble or any other, game of skill where you put up a monetary stake. You compete against each other, and the winner gets the reward. So anyway, they filed a lawsuit saying, "Hey, this is not equal protection of the law. We're just playing a game and making money at it."
Well, I'm not so sure that this is news, because Texas Hold'em has been, and all poker playing has been outlawed since around 2008-2009, when a law was. I guess it was 2010 when a law was kind of shoved in the back end on a national security bill. Because, of course, Texas No Limit Hold'em is a question of national security concern. I mean, it's the kind of thing where you could have Al-Qaeda coming in and they could be taking over Texas Hold'em tables. And I mean, that would be just disastrous for American security.
They could be going in and winning at Texas Hold'em and making
money. No, you can't do that.
You can't win at Texas Hold'em. Well, I mean, I'll be honest. I don't normally interject personal notes, but I play Texas Hold'em online for money almost every day. I'll play a couple of games. Now, the key is that this particular website and several others have found a way around the federal rules, and that is that you're not playing for money. You become a club member, and you pay a monthly fee, and they take that money and then put it into games where you don't have any monetary price for playing that game, but you can win actual cash. And I've won several hundred dollars over the past few months.
It's an interesting concept that they have that. I mean, you showed me that site, and I took a look at it. I didn't like the format, but the thing that strikes me about it is if they really wanted to, they being the feds, if the feds really wanted to, they could shut that one down. This is just a bunch of, gobbledygook and double talk in order to get around the fact that they're running a gambling operation. That's what they could argue.
Yeah, they're making enough money at it. They can hire a lawyer that will give the the feds enough grief about the literal statement in the law about putting up stakes. You're not putting any money at stake on any particular game. You're just a member of the club.
I don't think that would hold up if the feds wanted to crack down on it. Here's the good news.
They just do anything they want if they're in the mood.
But I don't think they really want to. I'm pretty convinced now that for those who don't know, there was an event that happened a couple of years ago. I think it was April of 2012, was it? They call it Black Friday, and that's where they shut down the major internet poker sites, Poker Stars and Full Tilt Poker, and I can't remember what the third one was called, but that's kind of an infamous day among poker players. But it's become pretty clear since then that was really just all about the U.S. government trying to stop the whole thing so that they could take control and start finding a way to impose taxes and regulations so that the Fed can actually make money off of this kind of thing, because they didn't like the fact they were being shut out.
Well, so, actually, the Fed is still making money. I mean, this company has to report the earnings if it's more than $600 a year or whatever it is. But what's happening in the background is
if it was based on just the current tax picture, they would have left the three sites up because all they had to do was just go after them for taxes. But they shut them down because what they want to do is they want to control the whole thing so that they get to decide who the major players are. I kind of suspect it's because they have connections to, the major mafia companies that own Vegas and Reno and Exit and all that kind of stuff.
That was the point I was going to make. It isn't necessarily that, the politicians want regulations and controls. It's that all of the major casinos in Las Vegas want to make damn sure that if you're going to gamble, they are going to get a cut.
That's right. Yeah.
And so if they put in enough regulations, the only people who are going to be able to provide online gambling are the Vegas casinos, because they've got the cash and the equity and the lawyers to be able to get legislation passed that gives them a monopoly, and that's the whole objective.
In the long run, it's going to be a case of poker becoming legal again, but it's going to be legal within the context of Vegas and Reno and Atlantic City and Mohegan Sun and all these others being able to basically control and dominate the scene, whereas before it was this company over in Israel called Poker Stars that was dominating the scene, and they sure didn't like that very much.
Yeah, no, that's true. Very true. So,
anyway, there's your poker lesson for the day. We didn't do anything about learning how to play a hand, but you learned a little bit about the game, So, let's see. I wonder if the NSA was listening in on that.
Well, maybe we should take a break a little early here, and then we can talk about the NSA.
Oh, you want to take a break? Aw, geez. Well, all right. I guess if we have to, we have to. Hey, this is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. You're on the Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be right back.
Okay, run back, turn up the dial. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown on this Thursday, February 20th. And just a little aside, Bill passed me a note. Hey, he's a grandfather again. Congratulations, guy. That's fantastic. What's your
name?
Making
me feel very old.
What's the newest member of the family name?
There's an interesting footnote to this. I was actually a grandfather before. One of my three daughters is kind of pumping them out. but it's somehow related to my birth, which was June 1st, 19 whatever it was, which also happens to be the date when the NSA provisions of the FISA law expire, June 1st, 2015, a year and a couple of months from
now. So you're anticipating a future birthday present? Is that the idea?
I'm hoping that the NSA will have been history by the time of my my next birthday next year.
Well, we'll keep our fingers and our toes crossed. Now the newest member of the family, what's your name?
Oh, gosh. You caught me. I don't know.
You don't know?
I think it's Chelsea. But I have to look. I'm having a difficult time keeping track of who's who.
Well, then I won't press you and find out what the weight was and which day she was born, because I would want to embarrass you on the air.
Well, there was a few names bouncing back and forth. My wife liked this name, and her son-in-law liked that name, and so it was kind of it only happened like a couple hours ago, so
wow.
I haven't gotten the final word on the official name.
Well, welcome to the world, JLC. I'm sorry that we couldn't give you a better world to come into, but we'll do the best we can with what we've got.
There you go.
So, now that the NSA was listening on that too, let's talk about the NSA for a little bit.
Sure.
Now we've talked previously about how the NSA, one of their stated purposes is to protect American business. Now, it turns out, apparently, they found an interesting way to do that. That's to snoop on trade negotiations? That's a pretty clever idea.
We kind of knew this. I mean, we kind of knew that they were tapping Angela Merkel's phone and stuff like that. Well, this actually had a headline related to one minor provision of some of the trade negotiations. And it turns out the Australians spy agency, one of the Five Eyes, was collecting all this information, targeting Americans, including businesses, law firms, and other organizations, and they said, "Wait, hey NSA, we got all this information. Do you want it? You know, it might be violating your client privilege laws. So, let us know what we should send, and we'll do that." And so, the characterization of the story was that one of the businesses was communicating with a U.S. law firm. I think it was Indonesia. It had hired a U.S. law firm to participate in the legal consideration of the various clauses in this trade agreement that's pending. And so Australia's spy agency was listening to it and recording everything. And so it wasn't that we know for sure that they actually sent all this client privileged information to the NSA. We just don't know whether the NSA declined it or accepted it. And this is something that was independent of Snowden. This was something that came up through the New York Times. So they've got their own source of leaks almost everywhere in the government. And this one particular came up, and because it involved a client lawyer privilege, it made a big splash in the news, but there's no evidence, no concrete evidence, because we don't know, because it's secret, whether or not the NSA got those actual phone conversations with the attorneys.
Okay, now hold on a second here, Bill.
Yeah.
We are talking about the NSA, right? This is the organization that has never missed an opportunity to overstep its bounds. So why should we even entertain the possibility that they might not have accepted the data?
Well, because they have to maintain the pretense that they're following the law. And in this particular case, the NSA, there's a specific provision that says they will not collect any communications between attorneys and their clients.
Yeah, but that's so easy. All they have to do is follow the normal, the standard operating procedure, which is lie about it and then take it anyway.
Yeah, well, that may be what they did. It's a little more difficult to lie about these things now because they're afraid the next week they're going to come out with a document saying, oh, yeah, of course we got it.
Nah, I don't think so. Because they haven't shown any sense of remorse. They haven't shown any sense of slowing down. They haven't shown anything that really says we're going to stop lying. Why should we think that it's becoming more difficult? I don't think it's more difficult for them. I think it may be more interesting for those of us looking from the outside in, but I don't see any sign at all that they've been slowed even the tiniest bit.
No. The thing is that the people that have the intelligence community constituency are the ones that get into the intelligence committees in Congress, and they're the ones that control the legislation. And so there's the chances of there actually being legislation brought to the floor, either in the House or in the Senate, is extremely small, you know, aside from superficial changes, because the congressmen have a vested interest in these surveillance companies in their states, and they are the ones that control the legislative process. So there was an instance, I think it was a month or two ago, where a Republican congressman actually managed to force a bill onto the House floor that would have stopped all the funding for the NSA programs. And it failed by, I think it was like 6 or 10 votes. And that scared the heck out of these Intelligence Committee chairmen because they didn't get a chance to review it and approve it for consideration.
It was just an Amish bill, yeah.
So, yeah, it's just an Amash.
Amash, whatever his name is, yeah.
Whatever. And I think they're scared to death that there's going to be another bill of that sort that's going to come out and do it. Now, the other thing they're waiting for, they don't want to do anything if they don't have to. And so the Supreme Court's got some cases coming up in the next few months that may close down the whole NSA surveillance program entirely. That could theoretically happen within the next 3-4 months.
And you think I'm gullible? Okay, well,
it's possible. They're afraid it might happen. Probably won't.
Case could fly. Elephants are pink. It's possible.
Well, I mean, it's possible that James Clapper could say he was sorry, and he did say that today.
I can tell you what is not possible. It's not possible for me to believe him.
Well, no, in a typical bureaucratic fashion, here's how you phrase it. We're really sorry that we're more transparent about this from the outset. I mean, right after 9/11, we needed to do what we had to do, and we thought we had the power to do it, but it was not a good idea to do it because look at the mess we've got now. So we're really sorry we didn't let people know.
Sort of an apology. Kind of, sort of.
We're sorry that the consequences of keeping everything secret were kind of foiled by Edward Snowden.
It sounds to me more like we're sorry we got caught.
Exactly. That's always what it is.
And as for them being concerned about Justin Amash putting through another bill and it getting passed, there's no way it's going to happen because it already came close to once. Now they're aware of it. So it's really simple. They just have to start monitoring Justin Amash and the other members of the Tea Party and so forth, and just watching to see if anything comes through all the stuff. It's real simple. This isn't difficult for them to do. This is what they do for a living.
Yeah, Snowden's documents are now a year old or so, and the stuff that he collected was fairly old stuff. So we won't learn about what they're actually doing right now unless there are leaks from other sources. And there was one leak regarding the pressure tactics that the NSA used against WikiLeaks. Now, this is way back in 2008, but it's kind of a new story. And the U.S. and the United Kingdom's NSGQ, or whatever the hell it is, was targeting WikiLeaks and other groups with tactics ranging from covert surveillance to prosecution, and they were actually making every effort they could to shut down WikiLeaks, which had released all these diplomatic cables, totally independent of Snowden, and this was years ago. So there's little things like that that occasionally trickle out. But otherwise, they're they're doing a pretty good job at keeping things secret and totally distorting the facts of the situation.
Well, it sounds like they're doing their job very effectively. I mean, nothing's really changed.
Keeping everything secret. Meanwhile, a footnote regarding Ed Snowden. This past week, he was elected as a rector of the University of Glasgow in England.
A rector?
A rector. Now, a rector in the United States is a member of the board of directors of the university. And not quite the case in England. It's more of an honorarium. But it's amusing that the members of the board or the students, I'm not sure which, actually elected Snowden to be an honorary chairman of the University Court in Glasgow, England, which is supposed to administer the university's financial resources, although they don't have real effective power. But it was kind of an amusing turnabout that people are trying to acknowledge Snowden's contribution and making a little minor, maybe gratuitous, acclamations for his efforts.
Well, first of all, a footnote to your footnote. Glasgow is in Scotland, not
Oops.
England.
Well.
We don't want our friends from the UK, and we do have some left. We don't want them getting upset at us, okay? I don't mean the ones who are.
Well, that's why we both.
I mean the real ones.
You know that Glasgow is in Scotland. I don't know that.
Well, it is.
Okay, I'll take your word for it.
Which means that Snowden's future releases are all going to be written with a Scottish accent. Okay.
Yes.
Let's see. We wanted to get to climate change. We've got Obamacare left. What do you think? Which way should we go on this?
Well, I think we can do climate change most any time. There were a few little news items about climate change this past week, but we've left Obamacare off the table for so long, I think we've got a little catching up to do.
All right, well, then we've got to do Obamacare. So what's first up on the list?
Well, it's something that you mentioned earlier, which was that Obama is basically rewriting the law whenever he pleases.
And well, so I already reported that.
Yeah, we said that, and the headline story was that, you know, here's the latest change, and what it involves, and this is something that relates well to corporatism. There's something in the law, it's like chapter 20,487 on page, 1756, called risk corridors. And what it does is it sets up various programs and methods for determining whether or not insurance companies need to be compensated for their losses. Now, the insurance companies wrote this into the law so that they wouldn't lose money. We've mentioned this before.
Oh, yeah.
So if their projections of what it was going to cost to insure the population are off, then the federal government is going to have to pay them for their lost profit. Now, there are, we hear almost daily.
If I'm wrong, they're guaranteed like 15% profit or something like that.
Well, it's actually, that's what I said, but it wasn't quite correct. They have to pay out 85% of their income in benefits.
Ah.
So that leaves 15% for their administrative costs and salaries and bonuses and all that kind of stuff.
Okay,
so it's not literally 15% profit that they're guaranteed.
Right.
But let's say they've got this program, they're selling it on the exchange, they're quoting a price, and if they lose money during the next, 6 months or whatever it is, then the government has to pay them the profit that they lost, this administrative expense margin. And so there are literally billions of dollars that could become, another bailout, in effect, for the Obamacare insurance companies.
But here's a question for you.
Yeah.
All right. The 15% is not their profit. It's whatever profit they have after they've spent the 15%. Well, if they spend more than the 15%, because their expenses exceed that, that's basically what this thing is saying, how do they know what the profit should have been?
Because in order to get on the Obamacare exchanges, they had to disclose to the administration what their anticipated costs were for each one of the different policies, how much they'd have to pay out, and that had to be this 85% thing. It's purely on the basis of estimates, on the basis of What's there's a word for what these accountants do with the numbers?
Criminology? And, oh, no, I'm sorry.
No, it's got nothing to do with reality. It's a projection. So the fact, which you hear in the news all the time, that there are only 3 million people that signed up versus the 7 million they had to have to break even, and that it's 24% are young people versus the 38% they needed to break even. Well, come March 31st, all the insurance companies are going to sit down, they're going to look at, you know, who signed up for what and what their costs were and what their actuaries think is going to cost them to do these policies next year. And as a consequence, they're going to come out with new numbers in a couple of months saying, here's the new price for the various policies that we're going to offer on Obamacare. And they are going to be, you know, like 50%, maybe 100% increased over what they were this past year based upon their experience with the current year. So what that's just another little, you know, glitch built into Obamacare. People are going to discover that the promise that Obamacare was going to save every family $2,500 a year is going to end up being an increase of, you know, $2,500 or $5,000 or $10,000 for the insurance policies they had a year ago. So it's kind of a little corporatist fluke that was, like I say, in this huge, massive bill and the huge, massive regulations they're writing that ensures that the insurance companies don't lose money. There's a bailout pending.
I'll tell you, that March 31st date is looking like it's going to be quite a date for me personally, because not only is that when, you know, all the spam starts to hit the fan in a bigger way, but as you know, my wife Louise and I moved from Virginia to Connecticut. Well, when we did that, we lost what we had as our old policy, and we're one of those who do not have an employer policy. We have our own policy. So we were partially grandfathered into what we had previous to Obamacare. Well, we lost all that, because since we moved out of area, we were at Anthem Blue Cross, and Anthem Blue Cross Virginia is not the same as Anthem Blue Cross in Connecticut. So that means we have to start all over again. That means we basically have to go into the Obamacare whether we want to or not if we want to have health insurance. So when I say March 31st is going to be a rather significant day, I mean literally that may be the day when I join you, Bill. That may be the day when I finally say, I can't afford health insurance anymore. I'm done.
When you go naked and you actually have to eat healthy food and take care of yourself.
Not really. Apparently, you can get the health insurance anytime you get sick, so why bother, you know?
That's true. You don't. Well, the March 31st deadline is something that was actually written into law and it actually remains in effect. That's a deadline when you have to have insurance if you want to get the tax benefits. In other words, if you want a kickback from the government on your insurance policy, you have to have it in place by March 31st. Otherwise, you can't include it on your next year taxes.
And I'm saying that's the day when I'll probably have to give up the insurance because I can't afford it anymore. Interesting thing, too, I was doing a little more research into it. You know how there are different cutoff points, and depending on what your income level is and how many dependents you have and all that kind of stuff, you get a certain amount of a subsidy or you don't. Well, I was looking specifically at what happens in the case of a married couple, like Louise and I, where we don't have children, so it's just fits the two of us. And it turns out if your joint income is, I think it's $62,040 or something like that, or less, you get a massive subsidy. If your income is $1 more than that, you get no subsidy.
Yeah.
I thought that was really interesting. It's not like a graduated thing at all. If you have a variable income like I do, because I'm self-employed, that leaves you at a place where you don't really know what to predict. Are you going to have to pay for all of it, or are you going to have most of it subsidized?
Well,
you don't know
if your
income level is close to that $62,000. Now, mine isn't, but seriously, that's actually a concern for people who are in that boat who are, you know, their income level is close to that, and it's a variable income. How the heck are they supposed to decide? There's no way to know.
Yeah, but look at page 2487 of the Obamacare legislation, ACA, and you'll find that it is actually bracketed. So, for example, there's a break point of $50,000 where you get, if you're less than that, you get full subsidy. If it's $50,000 to $100,000, you get 10% or whatever it is a write-off, and then it goes up from there, goes down from there.
Well, let me tell you, the bracketing didn't work real well, because I actually looked at what our numbers would be at those price points if our income levels were at those price at those income levels, and the difference was for my wife and I. Now I'm 50. How old am I? I'm 56.
Okay.
My wife's 59. Okay. Okay. So we're in that upper range, right? We're in good health, but we're supposedly in that range where everything starts falling apart, and that makes us higher risk and so forth. Okay. If our gross income was $6,250 or less for this coming year here, for 2014, I believe we would have ended up paying somewhere around $380 a month combined for the two of us for health insurance. If it turned out that our income was above that, we would have ended up paying somewhere around $1,000 to $1,100 a month.
Yeah.
So it may be bracketed, but the brackets ain't nothing to get excited about, let me tell you.
That's true. And they're going to change. As soon as the insurance companies, calculate their actuarial expenses and so on and so forth, they have to come up with new rates for all of their policies in advance of the October 1st deadline. Remember, that was a kickoff date? It's also the date for the new policies to be offered by the insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
So a few months before the election, we're going to discover how much of an increase there is in the Obamacare exchanges on the prices for all of those programs, which is not going to be good news for Obamacare fans.
That's what they're saying. Read all the Obamacare pro people, and they're saying, oh, yeah, this is going to be great. It's working out great. It's already working out great. And then all the claims about how the thing was falling apart because the website wasn't working, that proved to me not true. Look how many people have signed up. So they've already told us they know it's going to work.
Spinomania. Well, the big news on the ACA was the CBO report that everyone was making a big stink about, and they came out and they said, with the Obamacare program, the labor force will be smaller by 2.5 million full-time equivalent jobs than there would have been without it. In other words, Obamacare is going to motivate 2.5 million people to drop from a full-time position to a part-time or not working position. And it was bandied about because obviously the Republicans wanted to spin it that Obamacare is going to force 2.5 million people out of work. But what it is just a very simple thing, and that is the incentives for working cease to exist when you start offering these kind of subsidies. If you're paid not to work and you're given free insurance by the government, then why should you work? And so the flip side of it is, and this was beautiful spin, this is a good thing because people not working will have an opportunity to take care of their kids, and they'll have an opportunity to start up a new business, and they'll have an opportunity to, take a vacation. So it isn't that Obamacare is forcing people out of work. It's going to motivate them not to work because they don't have to in order to get their health insurance.
Boy, if anything could be possibly said that shows just how disconnected they are, you just said it right there. They're saying that if you don't have to work, you can start a new business. So in other words, if you start a new business, it doesn't take any work. Let me say from personal experience, you're full of it.
The actual White House that said it says, as part of this new day in healthcare, Americans would no longer be trapped in a job just to provide medical insurance for their families and would have the opportunity to pursue their dreams. This CBO report bears that out, and the Republican plan to repeal the ACA would strip those hardworking Americans of that opportunity.
Well, let me say something about that opportunity. It ain't what it used to be. I've been self-employed now for, let's see, full-time, it's got to be 12 years now, and part-time before that another 7 years. So what's that, 19 years that I've been self-employed either part-time or full-time? And I can tell you that it is at least 10 times harder now to stay solvent than it was 19 years ago. So they can say that all they want, but they're full of it.
Well, there's an amusing footnote that we'll finish off the Obamacare with. Under the Obamacare plan, aside from insurance companies recalculating rates, the Obamacare program itself is going to be increasing the cost of drugs. Now, the thing is, they mentioned lupus and multiple sclerosis people facing either a necessity to buy their own drugs at their own expense, or they're going to find that the price on the exchanges for these different drugs, aside from those, has gone up enormously because the deductibles increased. And the amusing side of this is, I wonder how that applies in those states that have medical marijuana. You know, is Obamacare going to cover medical marijuana?
Because I need some good drugs. I mean,
yeah, I was just going to say, are you on drugs? And so, which ones? You know,
I think they are for sure. But oh, geez. Well, we've got about a minute left before Scott shuts us off entirely. We need to get to climate change, but why don't you just pick one of the Obamacare pieces we've got left? We'll touch on that, and then we'll sign off.
I'm all out of Obamacare, although there was an interesting event Senator Rand Paul announced this class action suit. We discussed this a little bit last week, but he's getting a fair amount of news coverage because what he's doing is he's trying to get a case before the Supreme Court making everybody who is on Obamacare a plaintiff in this lawsuit. He wants to make it a class action lawsuit. And so although they're not seeking money damages, they just want to shut down Obamacare, it's an interesting approach legally that probably, I think we discussed this a little last week, probably isn't going to go anywhere. It's mainly a political document, not a real legal document. But I suspect in the next few months that the Supreme Court is going to start accepting these Obamacare cases, and there are dozens of them. And the effects of what they're going to do, not just in terms of what the law requires, but the way that Obama has simply ignored the law and done things that are totally contrary to the explicit wording in the law, the Supreme Court is going to have a real difficult time trying to show proper deference to the executive branch. So we'll see.
Well, fortunately, you and I are on the Supreme Court, so there's not going to be a discussion of the Constitution.
Hey, wait a second.
Hey, Bill, it's been a pleasure as usual.
Yo.
Hey, we'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.